Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is poker author Ed Miller. We will be discussing his new book called Poker's 1%, the one elite secret that keeps elite players on top. We'll be talking to Ed in a few minutes. Last week, our guest, gambling cheater Richard Marcus, generated many emails, mostly positive, some very negative. One profane-laced email kept saying that Advantage Gambling is not cheating and that by having an acknowledged cheater on the show, we are corrupting our show. I agree with the fact that Advantage Play is not cheating. I disagree that we're corrupting the show. I feel that by knowing various methods that cheaters use, players can better protect themselves while in a casino. We're planning having Richard Marcus on again in the near future.
Yeah, I agree. If you think you have nothing to learn from someone who cheats, I think your focus is too narrow. And maybe we'll ask Ed later if he would want to know if there were cheating at poker going on. I'm sure that poker players would be interested to know how they're being cheated.
I'm sure, and I'm sure there's several ways he can detect and probably some he hasn't yet, but we'll see. A few weeks ago, I said that Las Vegas' legacy of good gambling was one of the legacies of Jackie Gaughan and Benny Binion. We received an email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com that challenged this assertion. Our listener claimed that Vegas is nowhere near as good at gambling as it was 20 years ago. Whether we're talking about 6-to-5 blackjack, fewer match play coupons, the very rare 100% video poker, where the casinos penalize you for playing. This is all true. But that's comparing Las Vegas today with Las Vegas 20 years ago. My point was that Las Vegas today has better gambling than Atlantic City, or today, or Detroit today, or Tunica today, or most other gambling destinations. I'm sure this is true in video poker, at least for many stakes. Do you agree with this, Richard?
I do and I don't. I mean, okay. First of all, I have to say I walked through the Venetian and the Palazzo, and the main floor is now all 8-deck, 6-to-5, which I think is just a travesty. But we were talking about Gaughan, and if you even today, I mean, he wasn't really running the El Cortez still once he got to a certain age, but even today, they're still one of the few places left that has full pay, 3-to-2 single deck. They have, you know, loose video poker. If you look at the South Point, his son, you know, they have many, many double decks, the loosest video poker in Las Vegas. The only thing that Gaughan did wrong, in my opinion, was cheap and good food. That's the other thing he got right, and free booze. But the one thing that he did wrong, in my opinion, was sweat the money. Other than that, I thought he really had the right ideas about how to run a casino. But I think sweating the money, you know, you really turn your customers off.
You can get kicked out rather easily at the El Cortez.
Yeah, but even if you're not an Advantage player, if you're just a tourist, but you happen to be winning a lot, you know, you might get blood on your shoes from the way the pit bosses will sweat you.
All right. We've had two rather bizarre bits of gambling news recently. First, here in Las Vegas, there's a company that specializes in helping you join the Mile High Club, which basically means you and a partner get intimate while flying more than 5,280 feet in the air. They promise to completely sanitize the cabin after each romantic flight. Prices start at $800 per flight. That gets you half an hour. I guess foreplay has to be taken care of before you get on board. I don't know. While I'm planning on getting married next month, I'm pretty sure Bonnie won't think this is the right way to spend our wedding night. Richard, when you and Nelia join this Mile High Club, do you think she'll let you hang your certificate of accomplishment on your living room wall?
How do you know we haven't joined already, Bob?
I don't.
You know, the Japanese have love hotels you can rent by the hour, but $800 a half hour, I think, is pretty expensive. But hey, you know, there are a lot of crazy people coming to Vegas to do crazy things with their money, so.
Yeah, but we're both senior citizens, kind of, you're in your case, married forever, so it's not quite the same, maybe, as when we were younger. All right, more bizarre. There was a drunken man named Patrick McCullough in England who went to a bookie shop, and things got a little out of hand. After some altercation with security, Patrick McCullough decided to become romantic with a slot machine. So he dropped his pants and inserted his Johnson into some unspecified part of the machine. Anyway, there was an anti-theft device which detected the foreign object and immediately clamped down. Hard. Mr. McCullough wasn't that drunk and certainly did not remain quiet at this moment. Eventually, paramedics arrived with the help of angle grinder and some KY jelly, and were able to prevent irreparable damage to Mr. McCullough's privates. For inquiring minds, this particular machine has been permanently decommissioned. Is it true that this is the reason, Richard, that you prefer table games to slots?
I may switch. I don't know. I love this story, though. I mean, you would think that that should have happened in Las Vegas. You know, that should have been a Las Vegas story.
I don't know. Okay. It hurts to think about it. I'm thinking about that angle grinder they used to get him out and right next. That sounds pretty tough. Okay. We received another email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com discussing a man who was trying to figure out how to compensate people for a promotion after the fact. Richard, I'll let you start out with this one.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things about running a team is one of the important things is to try to think about every possible thing that can come up and have plans for these kind of things. You know, what happens if somebody gets mugged and the bankroll money gets stolen? What you know, how do we deal with that? Or, you try to imagine as many things as you can. And in this particular case, they have a pretty complicated compensation scheme. They've thought of they play a lot of different games. They compensate their players in different ways. But this was a promotion where basically somebody has to go pick up the money, you know, several times. And they
like
didn't
free
know,
play afterwards, something like that?
That kind of thing, yeah. Although although it wasn't free play, it was some kind of a rebate. You know, and with the people I play with now, you know, we would just decide. We would just come up with something, and really we would all try to do it in the fairest way possible. But the other thought I had was you could have a reverse auction. You know, you could get the team together and have a guy say, well, I'll go do it for X amount of dollars, and somebody wants to bid cheaper, I'll go do it for Y amount of dollars, you know. And I thought that was a good solution.
Is that what he came up with, or is that what your suggestion to him?
That was my suggestion to him. I don't know. You have any thoughts about how to compensate people for those kind of things?
There are so many different ways to do it. Of course, last year it turned out that the solution I ended up with was I got stiffed, and that was the way that worked, and that was after the fact. And so your solution definitely sounds better than that. Another interesting case is happening in Atlantic City. A Long Island high roller, Daryl Abramowitz, was invited to play at the Borgata and the Revel on two different occasions. He was promised RFB, room, food, and beverage, plus certain other incentives. When he ended up winning $23,000 at the Revel, they reneged on all their promises. When he won $105,000 at Borgata, they did the same. So he's suing. His position is that he lived up to his part of the deal, which was to gamble heavily, and the casino should be forced to honor their end of the deal, whether or not he won. Most APs agree with this position. What do you think is going to happen here, Richard?
Boy, I certainly hope he wins the case. And I just think that this is insane on the casino's part. I mean, my first thought was, okay, maybe the guy's a card counter. Well, even if he is, you have a contract, as far as I'm concerned, a verbal contract, but a contract. And if it were me, I would call my credit card company and say, I dispute these charges. You know, I wouldn't pay them. Now, you know, maybe the credit card company would deny it or whatever. But if they did this to a guy, a legitimate high roller who just happened to win, then they're insane. I mean, that's just crazy.
I agree. They're looking at the short term and saying $105,000, he won.
Yeah, you can afford to pay this $3,200 bill. Well, you know, do you expect the guy to ever come back? I mean,
They might have made a decision that they don't want him back, which is a different situation.
Yeah, that is a different situation, but I still think that they should, you know, they got to pay.
All right. Let's talk to our guest. Ed Miller is a low-stakes poker specialist and has written several books on low-stakes poker. He's a frequent guest on the show. Ed Miller, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Does that bother you to be called a low-stakes poker specialist?
I'll roll with it. I'm okay with that.
All right. It's reasonably fair. It's sure. All right. Now, your book starts about talking about not playing no-limit hold'em poker like a slot machine. What you really mean is don't play it like a video poker machine. I was going to call you up and bawl you out for using concepts interchangeably when they really mean something different. However, then I read one of your footnotes, which said, apologies to my friend Bob Dancer for calling a video poker machine a slot. Bob has carved out a career for himself playing video poker professionally. He's also created a lot of video poker educational material, and he teaches classes on the game. If video poker interests you, you look him up. So, apology accepted, and thank you.
So this whole question was for you to plug yourself.
Now, that said, what is that section all about?
Yeah, so when people sit at a poker table, you know, and this is not just new players, but this is often people who've been playing for a long time, their focus is frequently on the cards they get dealt and on trying to make hands. So very frequently people will sit and they'll say, okay, well, I have a king and a four of diamonds. I can make a flush with this hand, you know, and that's very heavy on their minds. And then they say, okay, well, I'll – and then they design their strategy around that. Okay, well, let's try to see a cheap flop with my king four of diamonds, and let's hope I hit my flush. And then when I do, I'm going to raise the turn or whatever. And the entire strategy is based around thinking about what they're going to do when they make this hand. And the reality is that poker doesn't play like that at all. Live, you know, game, not a machine poker, but live no limit hold'em doesn't play like that at all. It's most of the hands never go to showdown. So a lot of who wins and who loses at the game is based on if you bet and the other player folds. And of course, that has nothing to do with whether you made a flush or not. So the book, it's like the first chapter. Don't be fixated on what hands you can make, because if you do, you're completely missing almost the entire strategy of the game, and you're pretty much doomed not to be a winner over the long term.
All right. Now, you created two main rules of No Limit Hold'em. Number one, if your opponent bets or raises, you should usually call. Number two, if you bet one street and your opponent calls, you should usually bet on the following street. So, how'd you come up with these rules, and why, and are they unique to you?
Well, no, they're definitely not unique to me. This is lots of people have been thinking about No Limit Hold'em for many years now, and this book is mostly my interpretation of sort of the world of knowledge, not my sitting in an ivory tower and coming up with, you know, unique insights. So the rules are fairly simple, and I put them that way because I don't think most people think about the game this way. But if you think about it, they almost have to be true. So the first one says, if your opponent bets, you should usually call. And all that means is you shouldn't give your opponent cheap pots, right? So you shouldn't, if say there's $100 in the pot and your opponent bets $30, $40, $50 at it, if you're not usually calling, in other words, if you're folding more than half the time, you're giving your opponent an insane overlay. I mean, there's $100 that they want to win, and they're betting $40 or $50 to win it, and they win it more than half the time. They should make that bet every time, with every hand, no matter what.
7-2 offsuit.
Yeah. No, I mean, if that's the... If that's the layout, I mean, if that's the frequency is that I'm going to bet my $50 and I'm going to win this $100 more than half the time, yeah, it doesn't matter what you have. You should do it every time. So it follows that a correct poker strategy would involve not allowing that to happen in most cases. You can't just routinely allow that to happen and expect to win at the game. So that's the rule. The rule says if your opponent bets, you should usually call, because the opposite means you lose. It's really that simple. And the same goes, the other concept is sort of similarly simple, except that it's a little bit more complicated. But it says if you bet on the previous street and you got called, you should usually bet again. And the reason why this is a rule is because if you fail to do that, so let's say, you know, there's $100 in the pot and I bet 50 and then you call my $50. Let's say I usually give up at that point. Well, now it's the opposite problem. So instead of getting a cheap bet and a cheap fold, I'm getting a cheap call. In other words, I'm getting much more value for calling with that $50 than I'm supposed to be getting.
If I don't bet the next week.
Correct, yeah. If I can rely on you to give up, you know, if I just call this $50 and I know, hey, you know, this guy plays this strategy where, you know, every time I call this $50, he just gives up, you know, and doesn't bet anymore. Well, now I can call that $50 with, honestly, almost any hand in some circumstances, and I'm just counting on you to give up, and then I'm going to, on the last opportunity, I'm just going to bet and take the pot. So, or even if that's not the case, even if I can't just count on you to give up and just give it to me, I can count on you to give me cheap cards that I'm not entitled to. I can count on you to give me cheap showdowns. And it just ruins, if you don't follow up your bets correctly with more bets at the right frequency, it just lets me, it lets me call bets very, very cheaply, and it gives me almost no encouragement to fold.
So we had Paul Hoppe on a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things in his book was about paying attention to bet size.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a $100 pot and the guy bets $50 into it, you only need to win 1 in 3 times, right? To
1 in 4. Right, because you're getting 3-1
to call. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. 1 in 4 to call.
Yep.
So, but that now changes if he bets $100 into a $100
pot.
Correct. And so this gets very complicated very quickly.
Yes. Yes, it does. So yeah. So it's and this is one thing that I exploit all the time when I play. So in No Limit Hold'em, you can bet any amount from the big blind, so maybe $5 in a 2-5 game, up to however much you have in front of you, which is 500 or 1,000 or sometimes more. And you're exactly right. Every time you adjust that number, right, you're adjusting what your opponent's theoretically correct strategy is. If I'm going to bet $50 at you, then you need to call with more often than if I bet $100 at you. And if I bet $200 at you, you need to fold more, you know. So there's a continuum, and I get to set that number. So I can set it to whatever I want, 30, 20, 50, 100, 200, 500. And theoretically, you're supposed to kind of recalculate your strategy on the fly based on that. Well, the reality is people don't do that. people kind of have set strategies in their head how they respond to bets. Now, they might adjust their – if you bet $5 at them, they might say, okay, well, I need to do something different. Or if you bet $500, they might say, okay, I need to do something different. But within kind of a range, and often that range is really wide, from like 30 to 130, say, into a $100 pot, people will play, you know, roughly the same strategy. And if you understand that that's what they're doing, you can exploit that by kind of choosing bet sizes that are going to trip them up the most. You know, so if you know that they're going to tend to fold, you know, maybe half the time in a certain spot, you bet $30 or you bet $40, because that's more wrong. All that folding is more wrong the less you bet. And likewise, if you know they're going to call too much, maybe, then you might adjust your bet to a large size.
One of the main theses of your book, or perhaps the main one, is that everything you do should be frequency-based. What does that mean?
Right. So when I was talking about the slot machine, I was talking about how most people approach poker, which is thinking about what hands can I make? Did I make it? Oh, I didn't. I guess I better fold. And that's kind of the thought process. So people take hands independently. Okay, I have a queen and a jack. There's a king and a nine and a seven on the flop. Let me count out. It's okay, if a 10 comes, I make a straight. If a, you know, whatever. And that's how people, they're thinking about the hand just kind of in isolation. But the reality is that money gets transferred from player to player just like in any other gambling game, which is based on frequencies, which is like what we were talking about. If I bet and you fold half the time, then it doesn't matter what any of the cards are, right? I'm going to win money. If I bet $50 into $100 and you fold half the time, that's all I need to know. I don't need to even know anything about what's on the cards to know that's a good thing to do. And so what I advocate in the book is say, no, don't think about the hands first. First, you want to plan out what the frequencies look like. So you want to say, okay, say I raise preflop and someone calls, and now the flop comes a king, a 10, and a 3. And I say, okay, in this situation, how often do I want to bet? What should my betting percentage be? And then say, okay, well, I'm going to bet, say it's 60%. Say I decide I should bet 60% of the time. And then look at it from the other person's perspective. Okay, when he bets, what should my calling percentage be? You know, and think about it in those terms without even thinking about what hand you have. Just thinking about, hey, I need to call at least, if I don't call at least, you know, 40% of the time, then he should bet every hand he has. So I know I need to call more than that. Okay, if I call 80% of the time, then I'm calling with 7 high, and that's probably not right. So you kind of zero in on, just through trial and error and looking at kind of intuition, say, zero in on kind of a number. Well, I probably need to call about 65% of the time. And that's frequency-based, is you pick those frequencies first, and then you go back and fill them in with hands. You say, okay, if I'm calling 65% of the time, I need to look at every hand I can have here and say there's like 200 hands. You can write them out. The good thing about Hold'em is there's only two cards. So there's not that many combinations of possible hands at any time. So you say, okay, well, I can have 200 possible hands here. I want to call 65% of the time. That means I need to pick 130 hands I'm going to call with. And you could just go on paper. You could say, well, I'll call with pocket aces. That's 6 hands, you know. And you could just kind of go down the list and pick which hands you want. This is all away from the table, of course, but this is how you get better at poker, is by going through that kind of analysis on paper or at a computer away from the game.
And you say in the book that this is really what the top players do, that this kind of analysis is what the top players are doing.
Yes.
But I just have a hard time seeing Phil Ivey at home, you know, writing out, and I know Doyle Brunson isn't doing it. Okay.
Well, right. So Phil Ivey, I think, is a little bit of an enigma. But the thing about Phil Ivey is he started making instructional videos. So he used to be this. He used to never betray anything about his strategy. He was this kind of wall of of no knowledge. He would never tell you anything. But he started making instructional videos publicly. So he's now his thoughts on the game are public. And sure enough, he thinks about the game just like any other good player does. So, but yeah, this is what this
oh,
is.
Oh, really?
What,
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He is basing it on frequencies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he thinks about the game, as far as I could tell, just listening to videos roughly the same as any other, you know, kind of elite level player. But if you look at, I mean, there's a guy named Phil Galfond, and he is a bona fide elite player. He's won millions and millions of playing No Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha. He's, you know, generally acknowledged as one of the top players in the world, and he too has a video training site. And it's funny, I was writing this book, and then he happened to have one of his videos up for free, so I watched it, and sure enough, it was exactly the type of analysis I had in the book. He had a little pie chart, and it was about a situation on the turn. So he had a flop out, so he had four cards out, flop and a turn. And it was a heads-up match, and he's like, okay, my opponent bet, now what do I want my frequencies to look like? And he drew a little pie chart, and he had, like, pies, and he's like, 63% of the time I'm calling, and then he broke that up, and he said, and then I'm going to call, and then fold if raised, and that's 12%, and then if called, and call if raised, you know, 37%, you know, and he had this pie, and I was like, yeah, that's this book I'm writing. So yeah, no, there's no question that elite players, you know, they may not explicitly do it exactly the way I recommend to do it in the book. Everyone's different.
Sure.
But they're all thinking in these terms. They're all thinking in terms of, okay, I have X set of hands. I need to do this at least Y percent of the time. And I need to make sure that I have enough hands that I'm doing that with so that I don't get in trouble.
Okay. So one of the things that you talk about is identifying what the other players are doing wrong, mm-hmm. and that what they're doing the wrong percentage, and then exploiting that. Now, one of the most common things I see when I play in these games, which is I don't play very often, mm-hmm. one of the most common things I see is lots of players limping on the flop. So okay. So you get, you know, five callers limping in on the flop.
Right.
Okay, so now what's the best way to attack those players?
Okay, so what you're describing is basically people just playing too many hands to begin with.
Right.
So they're starting out with too many hands. The problem with that, there's a bunch of problems with that, but the main problem with that is most of those extra hands are junk. They start out as junk, and B, they often stay junk, you know, all the way through. So anybody who plays too many hands is going to have too much junk at any point in a hand. On the flop, they're going to have too much junk. On the turn, they're going to have too much junk. On the river, they're going to have too much junk. They're just always going to have too much junk. And then the question is, where do you hide it? What do you do with that junk? It has to go somewhere. It exists, and you have to do something with it. Well, there's basically two options. One is you can call all the way to the end with it. That's option one. So you
for
can
for them
just,
you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, for them. Yeah. So they're playing, I'm playing too many hands, I'm limping into every pot, I have too much junk, and now I need to do something with it. Well, option one is I'm just gonna call to the end. So if you keep betting, I'll just keep calling even though I have bottom pair, even though I have, you know, ace high, even though I have whatever, you know, the bad hand is. So that's option one. And you'll see people do that. Not so much these days, so much anymore, but you will see people do that. But what I find much more common is they fold it. They find a place to fold the junk. And typically, I'd say that happens the most on the turn. So they play their junk. Usually, I'll raise preflop if I'm in the pot. Everybody calls. Flop comes out. Everybody checks to me. I bet. Two people call. They've got whatever, but there's a lot of junk. And then the turn comes, and then they check to me again, and I put a big bet out. One that they don't want to lose, and then they fold. And I don't know how
now,
many hands I
big,
play.
Is that big bet a dollar amount, or is it a relation to the pot amount?
Well, it's sort of both, actually. So theoretically, it's a dollar amount. I mean, sorry, a percentage of the pot, right? Theoretically, it doesn't matter if we're playing $1, $2, or $100, $2. Everything is just percentages. But psychologically, people have numbers,
right?
You know, so when you actually go play 1-2, 1-3, 2-5, I'll give you the number here in Las Vegas. If you play 2-5 and your bet is over, I would say maybe about $150 in a 2-5 game. People usually buy in for $500 to $1,000. So that'll give you some sense of the scale. Certainly a $200 bet. That's a big bet. $150 is a big bet. Anything over that $100 is starting to get there. That's going to make people – they just give up on their junk at that point. They don't – you know, nobody's gonna try to bluff me if I bet $200 at them with that junk. So let's say I can't – you know, it's the turn, and they have, you know, 20% good hands and 80% junk, and this is because they played too many hands to begin with. And I put that $200 bet out there. Well, they're not going to get fancy with that 80%. They're just going to fold it. And that means I auto profit. So that means I just bet every time. I don't even worry about what I have because I've identified, hey, I'm catching them with too much junk in this spot, and they're not going to get fancy enough to challenge me. So I can just bet every hand I have and expect to profit.
Okay, so now the other thing that I see is in these low-limit games, on the river, they almost never bluff.
Correct.
I mean, like, and if they shove, they always have
correct
something. Yep. Okay, so now they are not bluffing frequently enough.
Correct.
So the way I take advantage of that, right, fold. I'm supposed to, is to just fold with
that's
me.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. If someone's playing correctly, you know, someone's a tough, strong, solid poker player, and they say they go all in for $600 on the river, you know, we're playing 2-5 maybe, and, you know, there's been betting, I bet, they bet, you know, whatever, there's and now there's $600 in the pot, and there's $600 left, and now it's the river, and boom, they bet $600 into that $600 pot. A strong player is offering you 2-1. They're offering you $600 to win $1,200, okay? So a strong player knows that they should be bluffing roughly 1 out of 3 times. In other words, they want to bluff at the frequency where, you know, you can't win or you can't lose. You could flip a coin almost. And you call. If you call 2 out of 3 times, you lose because they have a good hand. And if you call 1 out of 3 times, you win because they're bluffing. So there's no way to there's no win for you. And that's the ideal frequency for bluffing. Well, as you said, in these low limit games, people don't do that. If that $600 comes out, they're bluffing almost never, you know, and they're certainly not bluffing anywhere near a third of the time, which means you just fold. You fold everything. You fold anything that can't beat the hands that they would bet $600 with, which is usually everything pretty much.
Right. So one of the things that comes up a lot with blackjack players is, oh, maybe I'll take up poker. As if it's, you know, something where you can just go train for an hour and anybody can do it. How doable is that? How easy is it to become a winning poker player?
Yeah, so people do talk about poker like that. Like it's, you know, I'll just pick poker up. So first of all, I do want to say I think the threshold to become a winning poker player is pretty low. I think if you're a successful blackjack player, you know, you probably have the right mindset and the right set of skills already to become a winning poker player fairly quickly, you know, within a few months. Okay. However, we're talking about winning small amounts of money. We're talking about winning $10 to $30 an hour in 1-2, 1-3, and 2-5 games. Okay. And a lot of times people will talk about that like that's all there is to win at poker. Like, you know, the only thing you can do is win, you know, that's the ceiling. You top out at $30 an hour or something. But that's ridiculous. The reality is that that's where you top out if you're not very good at poker. You know, if you're a smart person who just
half sharp.
Yes, if you're a half sharp. I mean, that's the top out. And in reality, poker is a game. I compare it to chess. I think it's of, I don't know which is the more complex game, which is harder. But they're of, you know, roughly equivalent complexity. And so chess is a tough game. I mean, I don't think anybody would think, just because they're smart and they want some money playing blackjack, that they could all of a sudden storm, you know, a chess tournament.
Master, right,
be a chess master. I mean, people know that that's not reality. And poker has the same depth. So when you go to play poker at the card room, you go to play 1-2, 1-3, 2-5, right? You're playing with people who are all equivalently good to one another, and they're all terrible. I just, you know, and I hate to put it that way, but that's the reality. And I'm not saying terrible. I mean, you know, there's the good players in the game and the bad players in the game. I'm talking about terrible compared to Phil Ivey, terrible compared to Phil Galfond. Terrible compared to these players who have established themselves as the best players in the world. And I think people don't understand exactly how big the disparity is in skill level. You know, they kind of see, oh, it's a, you know, poker, it's a gambling game. I think, you know, EV, you know, I got this, pot odds, you know, I got it, right? And it's no, it's a game of equivalent complexity to, I mean, I've been doing this for 11 years. I quit my job 11 years ago. Since then, I've pretty much been doing poker as a full-time job. I get better every year. I mean, I have, for sure, I have learned a lot. I get much better year after year after year. I've been doing this 11 years, you know, and so, and I'm smart. So if you're starting on day one, which is not to say don't, but understand that there's so much to this game and there's so much complexity that you're not going to see all that complexity just, you know, in 4 months.
I think that chess is a good analogy. It's pretty easy if you're smart to go out and probably get to 14, 1500 chess player, yep. You know, which is better than the vast majority of chess players. But yeah, I mean, you would never win a game against a master, you know. So when Paul Hoppe was saying 5 big blinds an hour, you know, is a good win rate. Is that what you're talking about for these half sharp guys or?
Yeah. So what happens with poker is people find their level. This is just kind of like anything in life or lots of things in life. You know, people who play 1-2 regularly are not as good as people who play 2-5 regularly on average. Not as good as the 5-10 regulars, not as good as the 10-20 regulars. And then online has its own, you know, strata. You know, so there's the 25 cent, 50 cent players, blah, 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 all the way up to the top players. And the thing is that if you're playing at a certain level, almost by definition, you're roughly as good as those players. I mean, that's why you're there. You know, you're playing 1-2 on a regular basis because you're a 1-2 player.
Well, but wait a minute. You're playing 2-5, and mm-hmm. you're clearly better than those players, right? Because you're winning.
When I play 2-5, I win more than 5 bets an hour.
Yeah. Okay. I would hope so.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. But if you move up to 5-10... The actual dollars per hour doesn't go up. That's why you stay.
No, I don't stay. I play. I'm not a grinder. I do not grind poker for a living. So I am not putting in hundreds of hours. You know, I'm not putting in 1,000 hours a year trying to maximize my win rate. That's not what I do. I write a lot of books. I coach people. I play some. And so I play games, you know, I'll sit in a 2-5 game or a 5-10 game or, you know, a 1-2 game or maybe a 25 cent game online. I just like to play poker. I like to be kind of know what the game is like at every level. So kind of that's what's going on with me. I'm a little bit of a strange bird in the poker community. I'm not a grinder. I'm not, you know, I'm kind of my own thing.
Do you, really pay attention to picking the games that you play in, or is it? Or you just sit down, whatever's there.
No, I don't pay attention really. I almost welcome all different game conditions. Again, for the same reason. I mean, when I play, half of it I'm just trying to think of interesting things to write about, or you know, interesting things to talk about, or you know, I mean, that's kind of my what I'm going into. You know, but you know, and I feel like I'm going to be a winner in every game. I'm not going to play if I don't feel like I'm going to be a winner in the game. Pretty much, but I'm not trying to squeeze every last dollar per hour out of the games that I play, because I feel like there's more value to me in just seeing different things and thinking about it.
Okay,
because of what I'm doing. But if I was trying to make a living playing 1500 hours of No Limit Hold'em every year, then yeah, for sure I'd be super vigilant about it. And when I did that for several years. I played poker full time, and I was very, very vigilant about trying to always be in the best game in the room, for sure.
We were talking earlier about bluffing frequencies. How does that change depending on whether you're on the flop or the turn or the river?
Okay. So in No Limit Hold'em, people tend to bet size of the pot. Rough percentages of the size of the pot. So if the pot's $40 on the flop, they might bet 20 or 30. And then if the pot's $100 on the turn, they might bet 60 or 50 or 70. And then if the pot's, you know, $300 on the river, they might bet 200, you know, and so forth. So bet sizes tend to scale roughly with the size of the pot. What that means is if you look at it mathematically, you're actually looking at roughly equal situations. In other words, $30 into a $40 pot, $70 into a $100 pot, you know, $150 into a $200 pot. In some ways, those are very similar situations. And so what it is it's a series of three – flop, turn, and river are a series of three kind of independent, roughly equal decisions. So we went through the math on the river before. If I bet $600 into a $600 pot, I'm offering you 2-1. Means for you to call, you have to win 1 out of 3, which means I should be bluffing 1 out of 3. Basically, I should be betting hands that you have almost no shot to beat. 2 out of 3, this is oversimplifying it, but this is roughly the explanation. And 1 out of 3, I should be bluffing. Okay, so that zeros you out. If you, that makes your call break even. If I play that strategy, you can't win any money no matter what you do. You can flip a coin and you get zero. So we could just treat that as zero. If I am going to play that strategy on the river, the value of your hand once I play that strategy is zero. In other words, once I bet the river, your hand is worth nothing. So now we back that out. We say, okay, well, let's say I'm going to do that, you know, X percent of the time. So we know that X percent of the time, if you call the turn, your hand's going to be worth zero. So then you can recalculate how often you should bluff on the turn, and it turns out you should bluff more because, okay, you catch me now, I still get to bet sometimes on the river, and you still lose. So it means I need to bluff more hands on the turn. So that 2-1 ratio on the river turns roughly into 1-1 on the turn. So I should roughly bluff just about as many hands as I have value hands on the turn. And then the same logic goes toward the flop. You want to bluff even more hands on the flop. And so the ratio of value bets to bluffs on the flop is roughly 1-2. So for every one time I have an overpair or top pair or a set and bet that on the flop, roughly two other times I should be betting something else, like bottom pair or a flush draw or overcards and a gut shot, or, you know, any of the other kind of, you know, kind of wishy-washy hands you can get on the flop. So that's how it goes. You bluff the least on the river, percentage-wise, more on the turn, and the most on the flop.
But the least on the river is still higher than most people do it.
Correct. Most people do it almost zero on the river. Well, in many situations, most people will do it almost zero. You know, sometimes there are some situations people will bluff. Generally, when the pot's small, you know, they'll say, oh, I can take a stab at it for $50. Then they'll bluff. But if it's like a big hand and people have really, you know, been putting money in the pot and that $600 bet comes out, that's not a bluff.
Okay. Nevada has had online poker legal for several months. Last time you were on, it had just started and you were saying, yep, you were out there and profiting from it, enjoying it. Mm-hmm. What's the status of online poker today in Nevada?
So I want to say they started almost a year ago. I believe the first site opened the end of April last year. So we're almost at the year mark. There aren't that many games. I kind of thought that might be what happened. That was kind of the warning. There aren't enough people in Nevada. And I kind of said, well, you know, maybe tourists will play, maybe this, maybe that. But the reality is, you know, when I fire it up and I want to play, there's like two games going.
Are you playing at Ultimate or at Open Series of Poker?
Across both.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm not saying there's two games, period. I mean, if you want to play lower, you know, if you want to play 50 cent a dollar, there's more games. And you can play – if you want to play 25 cent, 50 cent, 50 cent a dollar, and that's your level and that's what interests you, you can play those games. But for me, and as I say, I'll play those games sometimes. But if I'm like, hey, I want to play poker and I want to make money right now, I'm in money making mode. I don't play those levels. I play bigger, and really, there's like not that many games.
Now they're supposed to begin pooling with Delaware,
yes.
Right? So when is that supposed to happen?
I heard that's supposed to start in over the summer sometime. So what that means is that Nevada signed a deal with Delaware. Delaware also has legal online poker that we're going to be able to combine player pools, and I don't know what the logistics of that look like. But theoretically, I'll be able to play poker both with people in Nevada and people in Delaware. Now, there aren't that many people in Delaware either, but the hope is that the structure of this deal will apply. So anytime a new state comes online, they can just strike a new deal, and boom, there's a new state added, a new state added. I know New Jersey would be great because there's more people in New Jersey. So, and then I think California is kind of the holy grail. It would be fantastic if they legalized and came online.
but they seem to be close. I mean,
I know. It's tantalizingly close, I would say.
So you would move to California, or?
Well, I mean, ideally, I wouldn't. I mean, I've set roots down here, so I wouldn't move to California. I would hope they would sign one of these compacts, so I wouldn't have to go anywhere. I could just play with California players. But if they didn't, in the meantime, I for certain will take trips to California and play there, because if California comes online, it will be fantastic for at least a while.
Now, good. We have there's a red chip site that we're going to ask you about after a few commercials. So please don't go away anywhere. We'll be right back as soon as we talk about some of our sponsors. This has been interesting so far. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. On Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, if you play 2,000 video poker points, you get to spin the virtual wheel. Now, they haven't had a Saturday, Sunday, or Monday in April yet, so we don't have any data as to how much these wheel spins are worth. In the past at South Point, it was correlated with what your mailer was. So the people who got $75 mailers tended to get bigger results of spins than people who got $5 mailers. I've been assured by the slot director that that is not the case here. So I will be trying it this weekend to find out what the spins are. Normally double points is, for 2,000 points, would be $6. So I'm assuming that the real spins are bigger than that. We shall see. Wednesdays, you earn 2,000 video poker points and get a South Point logo polo shirt. These are actually pretty nice shirts. They're Nike, and there is a South Point inch-tall logo on the sleeve, but it's not this huge blaze over your chest or your back. Free video poker class at the South Point next Wednesday at noon will be what video poker players need to know about slot clubs. This is how the slot in video poker players pick the game plus the slot clubs plus the amenities. And the slot clubs all over town are very different. The slot clubs at Palms is different than the South Point, different than Stations, different than Boyd, various combinations. And what's good for one player may or may not be good for another. What's good for locals may not be the best for out-of-towners. There's certain amenities that different people want. So that class gives us a framework to discuss to make those decisions. Next, at the Palms, in April, there's 7 o'clock drawings every Friday evening. Each week, $10,000 is given away to 10 winners. You earn 5 times entries Friday and Saturday, 8 to midnight, 2 times entries Sunday and Tuesday. This month's play for points, used to be called PEW, now it's PFP. For the first 2 weeks, you can earn Chevron gas cards, $10, $25, $50, and $100 of Chevron gas cards, and you can also earn car washes and lubes at Terrible Hertz. You may earn and redeem the points Monday through Friday, and the points last until you redeem them or April 12th, whichever comes first. The last 2 weeks in the month, the prizes are going to be Albertsons and Walgreens gift certificates. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a very wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw, Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, many others. These are often the best games in casinos, and you need practice to make sure you know how to play. They have monthly contests, and they vary by the week. This week, the featured game, there's 3 games. One is Dream Card. Dream Card is, you get 4 cards, and the 5th one, when it is a dream card, it turns into the highest valued card of the remaining 48 cards in the deck. And so it's a 10 coin per line game. So it costs twice as much to play. The number of dealt royals goes way, way up. The number of regular royals goes up. So the strategy basically stays the same. It adds a very small amount of EV,
but it does increase the variance. Also, you can play quick quads poker or extra draw frenzy poker in their contest. All right. Now, Richard, you came to town this week. You were going to ride the big Ferris wheel at the quad. How'd that work out?
I wanted to, you know, take a lot of photographs and write up a blog piece about it, and got there early this morning, and it turned out it didn't open until 1 o'clock this week. I guess it's going to be open 10 a.m. to 2 a.m., but not until next week. This is a soft opening or something like that. So I didn't get to ride it, although I may head over there after this and see if I can ride it tonight. So
all right. To me, you're paying $25 or $35 for a carnival ride. It's hard to see how this is going to be a sustained line. The first month or two, yeah, they'll have some lines. But it's hard to imagine this is a...
I don't know. It's very popular in both Chicago and London. They have, you know, these kind of things.
All right. So maybe I'm just not understanding it.
I was the sucker who wrote it in London. I enjoyed it.
I was the sucker who wrote it in Chicago where it's open air, and it was in December. So that's really being a sucker.
A stupid sucker to be. Yeah. All right. Now, so I got an email from you, Ed, today that said something about there was this Red Chip site where you're producing videos. And the first video is called something like "All Video Poker Players Are Terrible," and everybody can listen to it half price the first 20 minutes or so for free. And if you want to find out what the ending is, you gotta join up somehow. So what's this site all about?
Yeah, it's called RedChipPoker.com. I'm just started it. It's kind of a low key site. I started it with a couple other poker players and writers that I've worked with in the past. And I'm just going to do a video. I'm going to do a video once a month for it, and my colleagues are also going to do a video once a month. So there's a few videos every month. It's going to be a $9.99 per month subscription, so it's kind of a low subscription fee. And you'll just hear me talk about poker and, again, my colleagues in a new video every month. And so the idea is that it's you know, if you can't get enough of me, you can go to this new site and watch my videos monthly.
So after 6 months, there will be six of you and six of one colleague and six of another colleague. So playing the $10 a month, you have access to all 18 of those?
You have to be subscribing for the month to get access to that month's video.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So if you and then they go away?
No, you can buy them a la carte afterward. So the archive ones, if you really want. So this one's called "Everybody is Terrible at Poker," and it's some of what we talked about here, just talking about, you know, skill levels and how much money there is to win and so forth. So next month, if you wanted to watch this one, you know, you could buy this month's video. You know,
and who are the other players?
Doug Hull and James Sweeney and Christian Soto.
So all four of you are going to be putting a half hour, hour video every month.
Every month, yeah, and you get all four for the roughly $10 a month subscription.
And so they're called Red Chip Poker because that's the price of two red chips.
Yep.
I'm clever of me to work that out.
That's a lot of material to put out every week, every month.
Every month. Oh. So I think it's worth it. I think it'll be worthwhile.
All right. Thank you, Ed Miller. Thank you, Richard. Good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com. and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.